Hello, friends. Welcome to this month's episode of Chris Chambers Noir with our favorite noir writer, Christopher Chambers. Today, we are talking to two amazing women. Chris says psychological thrillers and cop suspense aren't noir. Oh, hell no. These two ladies are award winners, bestsellers, and queens of crime. And Tracy Clark and Christina Kovac will explain all about that today. So I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. And now I'm going to turn it over to Chris.
Thank you, Hope. And just a reminder, we are live now and we are available on iHeartRadio, on the Incandescent Radio Network, on Apple Podcasts, and on Spotify. So tune in. Listen in on your favorite channels, and we are visual and all that here on YouTube as well. So you get to see what's going on. You get to see the sausage made, because that's what's so fun about crime fiction. It's about sausage grinding. But we won't say what's in the sausage, though, unless it's a cozy. And then it's real sausage, sadly. But in any event, I'm so proud and honored to have Christine Kovac and Tracy Clark here. I wanted to dispense with the fawning, but I still have to fawn. First of all, because they're wonderful people. Number one, okay, that's the best thing. Number two, they're also best-selling authors that have publishers that pay for big tours and stuff like that. So I feel, my little insignificant self feels so honored to have them here. Because I spent all this time doing these great graphics you see behind me, which will be reversed, of course, on YouTube, that it took me 5 seconds to scribble up there. We don't have the Jennifer Hudson dance line. Maybe we can do that later, before we sign off. But here's what I want to just say. And you had the kind of intro as to, police procedurals, psychological thriller, suspense, that, that's not noir. No, I mean, the noir DNA is there. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into that nitty gritty very soon. But before that, I have to do what I call my impertinent icebreakers. So my first impertinent icebreaker is going to be with you, Ms. Clark, because every time I've been at the Edgars with you, I've been at BoucherCon with you, and you just, collect those awards like this, ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And I'm up on my feet screaming, and you kind of sit there, and you're like Marlon Brando when he found out that the guy got the horse head in the bed, and he's like, meh, yeah. And, and I got to say, I mean, what is that all about? Now, I mean, I know, everybody kind of battles a certain shyness, but I mean, is this kind of like just a journeyman thing? Is it a Chicago thing? Like, all right, I won. Now let's go on and do something else. Or, why am I the one up here screaming? And you're like Vito, like, okay.
That's bring panic. More it's on. Called panic, Chris. That's me thinking about that long walk up to the podium. And me not having anything to say. Okay, so it's panic. It's joy afterward. Once I've won, which is wonderful. Your peers have and your readers have voted for your work, which is always, self-affirming. And it feels good after the fact. But I'm thinking about, please, God, don't let me trip over something. Let me get up there and think of something to say that is halfway cohesive and just get off as quickly as I can. Okay. After the fact, then I'm in a good mood and ready to go. But my name comes up, panic, everything goes out of my brain. And then you have a potato up there trying to look halfway cool, and it's not going to happen.
I knew you were going to say all that.
Then why'd you ask me?
I mean, because I wanted to call bullshit on it. And we can say words like that on my podcast because it's hard-boiled noir. I want to call bullshit. Because you have such an amazing body of work, and that excuse might have worked maybe 5 years ago, but that excuse doesn't work now. I'm sorry, I'm putting
it
you
does.
On the spot.
It does, because I'm thinking about the work. And so once I have gotten something on the page that is halfway decent and readers like it and is getting these nominations, which is absolutely wonderful. It feels good. And to win is even feels better, you know, but I'm thinking about, the book is done. I did okay with it. It wasn't trash. People like it. And so I can move on to the next thing. I'm not really one of those people who sort of, you know, bring the balloons and streamers out, because it's always internal for me. I did mess it up. It's good. It's all right. Okay, let's move on to the next one. Let's see if I can do better with that. So I'm always thinking about words on pages, character, digging and getting those characters out. And whatever happens out after that is icing on the cake. It's absolutely wonderful. I enjoy it. I thank everybody sincerely from the bottom of my heart. And then the next book has to be worked on. So, you know, maybe it's a Chicago thing. We don't get really
Yeah, I
upset.
was about to say it's that Midwestern, like,
Unless the
shucks,
Bulls win or the Bears win, you know, it's all.
Well, we won't talk about our football team here, the Commanders. Well, now I got to move on to here because we have a real, here's the impertinent icebreaker, a real swamp dweller here in Christine, because look, we're going to get to this too. I mean, we have two journalists here. One of them, print background, drill down, very serious. I mean, no surprise here which one it is. But then we have you, which is Christine, a true swamp dweller, a maven of TV, of DC political TV. I mean, you check every enemy box that probably, some of these clowns who have occupied our city
Yes.
usually pull out.
Yes.
But I'm going to put you on the spot here because this is not about the swamp. It's an impertinent icebreaker. You had a very wonderful bunch of launches, and so did Tracy. But at one of your launches, you were interviewed by another bestseller, great person, Angie Kim, at Politics and Prose here in D.C. And you can't get much more D.C. than that. And in that interview, you had on what had to be the bossest black boots I have ever seen in my life. I mean, Lieutenant Uhura, Nancy Sinatra, and Krista Faust, who was on the last episode of the show, would all been proud of those boots. Now, is that the real Christine? I mean, do you just want to like put those boots on and stomp people? Just really just get them. I mean, what is with those boots? I mean, are they an accoutrement, or are they a weapon, a reflection? Tell me about those boots.
Chris. I am not wasting those good boots on those yahoos. I am not. I have my Doc Martens for the ass kicking. That's what I have. Those are my pretty boots. Those are the ones that
Okay.
Angie and I, we were like, what shoes are we going to wear tonight? Because you know that's the only thing that matters at a book launch. And she wore
Which
her
is true sometimes, right?
and she was doing her pedicure in the green room for Politics and Prose, and I just shoved on the boots and we were ready to go.
It's you
That's a little
see,
too inside baseball, isn't
no. Inside baseball is what this is all about. That's what podcasts are all about, taking inside baseball and making it everybody's business. Because
it?
it's such a we see different types of styles about how people interact, and again, when you look at their backgrounds, again, Tracy's background as a journalist is in print, and that's the drill down, like really, serious stuff. Unless she was covering a panda birth or something at the zoo on the north side, but and then you were with NBC and Tim Russert for a couple of years, and that and it's
Well, sure. I mean, during the Obama administration, but I started in the street. I mean, I was a local news girl. I lived on
right.
Capitol Hill, 600 block of A Street Southeast, back when one of my friends who's a police officer said, you know, there was a girl 2 blocks down the street who looks just like you who disappeared. So, I mean, don't let the boots fool you too much. I mean, I know the TV thing, And even when I did NBC News with Russert, who was like the last of the greats. I mean, he is for real the last of the great journalists. When he died, I felt that like September 11th. You know, it was just like, okay, that's the end of something, and then we're going into something else. It was like, you know, leaving the White House Christmas party at the last Obama Christmas party, walking onto 15th Street and knowing that you're going into something else. I mean, it just felt like that extreme, like something is different now. But Tim could be gritty. I mean, you know, the thing is, Tim wasn't just politics. He was best at politics. But he had us chasing. I mean, I chased Chandra Levy. I mean, I didn't chase her, but I chased, you know, tried to chase the guy who, you know, killed her. You know, Monica Lewinsky. Well, that was more political. The DC snipers.
Right.
You know, I started out in TV, 23 years old, running around sometimes with nothing more than a microphone, during the height of the crack epidemic in DC. And a lot of people suffered, and a lot of people deserved better. It was a really tough time. So, you know how to clean up for TV, but there's always, and that's what I kind of like writing about. You know how to clean up for TV. This is what it looks like, except for that's not really what it is.
Well, let me ask you. I'm going to push this question to the forefront, though. I mean, go back to Tracy. I mean, how did your journalism career, how does it seep into your writing? I mean, it can't just be, well, I don't mind editing and have other people edit me. I mean, is there something transformative or existential about the journalistic background that you had, Tracy? I mean, and does it pour into the work? I mean, I think it does, but I mean, what is your opinion of your own self?
I think coming from journalism, I sort of write differently, I think, than most people would. I'm writing kind of like a news story. Actually, when I first started writing fiction, it was really tight, it was really short, it was really bam, 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 who, what, when, where, how. I had to sort of teach myself how to expand beyond what the essential information is. So I had to sort of teach myself to sort of put all the other stuff in it. So I think coming from journalism to fiction, especially crime fiction, you sort of drill down on what are the essential elements. You're looking for truth, you're looking for realism, you're looking for words that pop. So you're always looking for this, this, this. And then the other stuff that you sort of teach yourself how to do, you put that in there too. But you sort of, I write really simply, okay? Really fast. The chapters move really fast because I'm trying to get, you know, just the essential things in, character two, all right. But I'm not flowering it with, you know, oh, this red vase sitting on this. I don't care. I don't care what color the vase is, unless somebody's going to get hit over the head with it. I mean, so I'm looking at basic information, enough to sort of get you to sort of engage with that character, get that sort of interested in that milieu, the setting, Chicago. That's a character in the books too. And I whatever I need to do to get that central information down, that's what I do. And I'm not putting in any, you know, balloons and lollipops and all the rest of those fun things that, you know, people sort of like to read, you know, when they're on a Sunday afternoon with a, you know, a little tea or something like that. That's not me, okay? I'm writing grit, I'm writing rats, I'm writing things that I see on the streets of Chicago, I'm writing the Riverwalk, I'm writing dumpsters that smell like sour milk. Those things are Chicago. I'm writing about Chicago, and that stuff is ingrained in my characters, and I'm writing that. I'm zeroing in on that. So you're looking for
Well,
the bang bang, this ain't gonna happen over here. I mean,
you just wrote a treatise for us here. I'm gonna call George Pelicanos and say we gotta copy this down and try to steal it from her before she copyrights what she just said. But Christine, what about you? I mean, how does you know the background? And again, I have my own opinions, and because it does come through in your work. But I mean, what's your opinion of yourself in terms of how that, you know, honestly, you know, bleeds into the work, your background, TV, especially local and national. Yeah, this is
an interesting city. This is a local city and a national city and an international city. I mean, it's unique among any in this country. But go ahead.
I write differently than Tracy. That was so interesting to hear you say that because in TV, I'm a little bit older. So I started in the 20th century. It's like historical. But we used to lay first video and then track, that's the audio over top. And that was the story. And you always write to pictures. And this is really hard for anybody to understand in the digital age, but I'm very visual. I look for visual things. Now, Tracy's right. I mean, like nobody wants to hear about a red, what color a vase is. But I do like to make sure that people see where they are. I think DC is beautiful. I think it's vibrant because of all the different kinds of people and the different sounds because they come from all over, the world. I think that every single neighborhood has a different vibe, and I try to get that like you get from a TV camera. I'm always trying to make the words disappear. So I think I'm kind of doing what Tracy is doing, but like I call it different things just because that's the language of TV. Always in TV, you always wanted the pictures to tell the story. Words should be just inhaled. It's not something that you're ever aware of. We had this anchor named Brian Williams, and he was always like, adding all these superfluous words. And we're like, you're using up all the video. You're just not hitting your beats. He was just awful. So I always try to remember to hit my beats and to make sure that I'm giving just enough of the pictures of DC. Because the other thing is that DC is seriously, and I'm sorry, Tracy, it's the most beautiful city in the country. It just is. We can drink to that. But I mean, I just think it is. I think it is. It looks beautiful, and there are things behind it that are not beautiful. And that's the really fun place to play in fiction.
Well, let's keep all that in mind, what you just said, because I'm going to bring all that back when we actually start talking about noir and noir elements, and breaking down these walls among these silos among these subgenres. But let's go back, since we to Tracy. I mean, tell us about Edge, just launched. Tell us what Harriet's into now, and what's different about this. You've got the one word titles. I love that kind of crap. And Harriet too. But what's different about Edge?
I think what's different about Edge is not so much the procedural part of it, because it's a police procedural and they have a case each time. I think what is different about Edge is because this character, this Harriet Foster, is in a different place than she was in book one, which is really sort of enthused me to sort of, I'm really enthusiastic about writing characters. Characters always come first for me. And when I wrote her on that first book, Hyde, she was in a really dark, empty place. And over the course of this series, she has sort of shifted. Not a lot, just sort of maybe half turns of the screw. But she's gotten a little better each book out. And so when we meet her in Edge, she is at the edge. It has sort of a double meaning, the title. The edge of where she was and where she needs to be. And she's sort of gotten to the point where she can sort of say, I need to change. I need to move. I realize that now. And now she's got to make a move. So, Edge is also the name of the toxic drug that is sort of hitting the street. So that's what their case is. But she's has to move. She's moved a little bit over the four books, and she's at a sport a spot where maybe her eyes are a little bit more open, and she knows that she's got to do something. So, that's what this is different about this book. That's what is sort of excited me about writing it this way, because I wanted her to, get better. I mean, we meet her in book one, and she's not doing too great. And so I kind of like happy endings, even if I don't write them all the time. And I wanted her to sort of be okay. And so this edge is sort of her beginning of being okay.
You heard my little snicker at the end. If you guys audio caught me, so I don't usually write happy endings. That's like
I know.
understatement. And we're gonna come back to that as well. And we talk about noir. Christine, what Watches Fall, people use these labels like psychological thriller, and we're going to talk about that too. We're going to talk about the industry, and these terms like thriller, psychological thriller, and everything. But in Watch Us Fall, what were you trying to convey there, and in terms of a psychological thriller and this kind of tenseness of among a group of people, and you have your DC element to it that adds to that. What tell us about the book, which launched, both of you guys launched this week. So go at it.
Watch Us Fall is a specific kind of crime novel. It's psychological thriller in that it's about competing stories about two different, maybe more actually, different takes of what happened. And it's up to the reader to kind of decide what is true and what is not true. I called it Watch Us Fall to begin with. It's about four post-grad women who live in Georgetown, a stone's throw from their alma mater. They had just graduated a year and a half before, so they're quite young, 23, 24, 25 years old. And they're living their best life. They have decided that they're always going to be together, they're best friends, they're going to live together no matter what. And they're struggling the way we all struggle when we get out of college, just trying to find our way in the world. We've left a place that was secure. We haven't found our way yet. So it's like kind of in between this kind of crossroads. It's really very choppy. And I know I just used a road with a river, but you get what I mean. It's like, it's just a lot of upheaval in their lives. And the main character is a woman named Lucy Ambrose, and she is best friends, and she loves, like a sister, a woman named Addie, who she lives with. And Addie falls in love with a famous journalist who is the son of a former presidential candidate who died while during a campaign. And he is riddled with all kinds of emotional issues that stem from that. Addie and Josh, the man's name, Addie and Josh break up mysteriously, just like they had this obsessive kind of relationship mysteriously. And they break up. Addie doesn't want to talk about it. A snowstorm comes and he disappears.
And mayhem ensues.
Well, I'd say the girls.
Unfolds, actually, because it is
Right. And so
suspense.
the girls decide to go, looking for him. And of course, as often does, suspicion turns around and boomerangs on them. So that's where really the problem lies.
Well, let me. This is a good jump-off point to the thesis, the meat. We silo sometimes in these subgenre titles, police procedural and things like that. I've had the first episode, I guess it's episode two, I guess, what we had with Gary Phillips, and we were going back and forth about like, what does all that mean? I mean, people say that there were three kinds of subgenres in crime fiction, the kind of protoplasm. There was, cozy, the hard-boiled, and the police procedural. There was like the three prong, I mean, or the three legs on the stool. And then everything kind of coalesced around that in the primordial sea. And then we get, the super predators like domestic suspense coming in and eating up everything. And then the rebirth of noir and hard boiled. And that it had a very bad rap early on in the 20th century because of misogyny and racism and stuff like that, but then picked up by the very same people that it looked to demean, such as minorities and women, around the same time, and developed in another path. So that's for a book that probably should be written. We'll get Angela Babbar to write that one. But you guys look like you break down a lot of these walls. Like, for example, Tracy, you talked about Chicago as a character. I mean, Despite my, demeaning your city and that those stupid hot dogs that you have,
What?
and those that bucket that you can't claim as a pizza, as a bucket of
Dude,
meat with
stop. Dude.
I knew I was ready for this. Go
Get a
ahead. Go
business.
ahead. Call
Prepare
me a
yourself.
Philistine. Call me a
No.
Philistine.
Just go on. Just go on.
You don't put caraway
Oh
seeds on a bun and a pickle on a hot dog. Come
my
on.
We're trying to keep you healthy. All right, there's a tomato, pickle, all kinds of crap. All right. Come on.
I do like the rib tips. I like the rib tips. The rib tips are good. And Christine, to give you some context, we go back and forth all the time, and it goes back to a relationship I had a long time ago. And the young woman's mom used to send me out in the middle of Chicago snowstorms to buy fists of Crown Royal from Jewel Osco all the time. So that's my Chicago stuff. I like Chicago in the summertime. I like splashing around not too far, right there with the skyscrapers right there in that dirty, dirty lake of yours. But here I go. Christine, because our Potomac is so clean and
I was going to
pristine,
say the
right?
Tidal Basin is disgusting. It's disgusting.
But going back to you have Chicago as a character, because this in noir the setting is a character, and you said yourself you're interested in the characters. And George Pelicano said that noir is a stylized realism that envelops the characters. And even Gary Phillips and Christa Faust said that noir, it is character driven, as opposed to what you have, and I don't want to belabor this, we're going to talk about this in a minute, the kind of industry standard of when you're so stressed with stuff like domestic suspense now, where everything's got to be propulsive and twisty, almost like, if it's not propulsive and twisty, then it's not real crime fiction anymore. I mean, that's the message that the public is getting. And noir, for years, decades, and even now, kind of cuts back on that. Tracy, what do you think do you agree with that, first of all? And second of all, what are the more noir elements in Edge? And then going back all, through Echo and Fall, that you can kind of put your finger on. It doesn't have to be dictionary, noir, hard boiled, but what threads do you try to tie into that?
Well, I stopped listening at the hot dog, but I'll just try to.
I kind
Okay.
of figured you didn't hear me call the pizza a bucket of
I don't
tomato
know what else you
sauce
said,
with
but
meat.
I think I don't sort of deal with the definition because I'm not just not that kind of a writer. I'm one of those seat of the pants kind of people. So I think I hear the voices. I have an idea of what I want the story to be or what I think the story is going to be, and then I just write. When I think of noir, I'm thinking it's sort of dark and gritty, and I get that. But you've got the hero against the sort of anti-hero, really, sort of. And it's sort of everything's fatalistic, and nobody's there's no right, and no there's wrong, there's no clear-cut sort of boundary of what those things are. And I think crime fiction, or at least pre-I novels or police procedures like I write them, are kind of like offspring of noir. They're sort of offspring of noir because you've got your hero, right? You've got your Don Quixote, whacking at the windmills and everything. And you've got this sort of reluctant hero, okay, taking on the big guy, corruption or whatever it might be, some serial killer or some governmental corruption. But he's going against all of these big sort of elements, and he's not sure whether or not he's up for it. Neither are the people he's fighting for. He's got his own set of ethics. He sort of goes by that. And there's at the end, there has to be some kind of resolution. There has to be some kind of triumph, whether or not he gets the bad guy or not. I mean, he has to sort of solve whatever the thing is and so live to fight another day. So that's how I look at it. I think noir is a lot more darker than that. And there's no really clear outcome. The good guy may be a good guy. He may not be a good guy. He's doing maybe good guy stuff, but he can be easily turned to the dark side, so to speak. I mean, so you never really know where you stand, where things were going on. You have to have a hero in crime fiction, in my opinion. Your protagonist is the person that your reader is sort of sits on their shoulders and goes through the story on, and they have to sort of believe, even if they're sort of dusty, that they're fighting the good fight against this big, unwielding thing that they're sort of crushing the little guy. So that's what I'm looking at it as. And so that's kind of how I write my protagonists. They are in this to win it. They might not be up for it. They might not feel they're up for it. They might get knocked down five times, have to get up six. That's the kind of plotting sort of a moving forward kind of a thing. So that's what how I see it. It's probably not definitionally right because I don't have time to look it up. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I'm busy.
Well,
It's cold here. It's like 18 degrees. I ain't got time.
I understand. I totally understand. I mean, because it seems to be in the police procedural kind of realm, noir is more of a it's like it's something you take off the palette and you're painting with. It's more of a tool rather than, the underlying support
I
for the
think we're
story and the
taking the noir.
characters.
We're taking the noir elements, the grittiness, the darkness, the underbelly of society. We're not dealing with, happy, shiny people. These are people who walk the streets. These are people who are looking for angles to sort of, stab somebody in the back. We're looking for people who are not operating like we think society says they should be operating. And so your hero cannot be some shiny thing either. I mean, he's in there in the trenches where other people fear to tread. And so he's in this muck and this grit and this rat infested world, and trying to sort of make it out. And so we take, I think, noir elements, the darkness, the grittiness, blah, blah, and then we make a little something different out of it. It sort of has a little turn to it. It's not simply 100% noir, but it's noir-ish, and then it has this new element of this new thing that we're sort of working with. So that's the way I look at it. And
Hey, you get no argument from. I'm not here to argue with anybody.
sound like a word.
I got
Sound
that out of
like
my
a
system
word.
with Gary Phillips, and then we have a whole bunch of guys from Kentucky coming on next, and Chad Williams and all of them, Bobby Matthews. So I gotta get prepared for that. So you guys are the hors d'oeuvres here. I gotta get ready, get some bourbon, and get ready for them in a couple of weeks. But Christine, with again, I'm gonna and for those of you who are not looking on YouTube, I'm gonna use air quotes, psychological fiction. Is it the same kind of thing, or are you basically using the noir elements as a tool, as a as some kind of a vehicle? Is that how you see maybe the evolution or the current status of your subgenre? Let the listeners know.
I totally respect what Tracy just said about taking whatever you need from any subgenre or anything to get where you need to go, to get where you need your character to go. That said, Watch This Fall is a psychological thriller just because it deals with truth and lies and delusion. It deals with the stories that we tell ourselves when we can't face the truth. It deals with competing stories. There is no place that is more noir and that has more competing stories in my mind than Washington, D.C. If you look at the absolute, almost gangster corruption that goes on in the federal government, and then they turn around and say, well, the problem with D.C. is, and even the people who want to come to Washington, who aren't even here yet, say, well, the problem with DC is, and that's a very, the misassignment of blame is a very, and corruption is very much a DC thing. It's built almost in, I don't know, was it built into Home Rule? I don't even know. But DC is so often used as a scapegoat for the bad policies incompetence and I'm just going to say it, the lies that are coming out from the administration, the Supreme Court, and the United States Congress. And, and all that is kind of just built into whenever you just put a place in DC, put an envelope in DC that actually cares about DC, where you actually feel DC and you actually talk to DC people. Josh Egan, who's the character, the missing man in this story, his father appeared to be a Kennedy-esque figure and was not. And that is such a that goes beyond noir and that goes beyond really I think even crime fiction. It's about who are we and how do we deal with the fact that our fathers and our forefathers are not who we thought they were. And that's why where Watch Us Fall comes from, kind of, it's like Watch Us Fall when we realize these things that we believe, these truths that are self-evident, people don't actually believe, or they come to DC to argue, don't believe your lying eyes. When you look at these beautiful buildings that talk about freedom and equality and justice, but then they want to argue that what we're seeing is not really freedom, justice, inequality. And so there's kind of a noir element to that. And I often think of DC, I mean, of course, when you're not talking about specific neighborhoods like, the cool cafe down in Adams Morgan or, Rock Creek Park jogging path, when you're not talking about that, the first thing you think about is DC at night, those beautiful white buildings against the dark night sky. And in some ways, there's just nothing more noir. Did I answer your question even?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I mean, especially when the themes of delusion on a macro level and a micro level personally, I mean that's noir. I mean that's Chandler and Chester Himes and all those people. There's self-delusion on the micro level, and it just percolates up and then it comes back down. And as Tracy said, it suffuses the whole underbelly, and it depends on and Tracy, you can kick in here. I mean, a lot of the self-delusion that you might see comes from being in the underbelly. I mean, I think that's when you look at DC, especially the DC novel now, as opposed to 30 years ago. When Jim Grady was writing, the Condor or Robert Ludlum, and you look at places like Chicago now, I mean, people are concentrating on the underbelly. And in my opinion, and Tracy, I don't know if you agree with this, I mean, sometimes self-delusion for people who are caught in the underbelly is the only way to cope. There's a school of thought that says that a lot, the violence in some of these communities is not just a cry for help. It's a way of coping because there is no way if you're a rat caught in a box, aside from chewing off your own arm, the natural inclination might be to bite off the arm of the rat next to you because you're being pressed and pressed and pressed and squeezed. I mean, Tracy, is that, do you find any purchase there? I mean,
I
or
don't
is
know. I think if you live in the underbelly or you work in the underbelly as cops do, there's no delusion there. You see it, okay? It's not like somebody can sort of paint a shiny picture for you and you choose not to believe it. That's delusion, okay? That you can't be deluded when you're stepping in blood or stepping over bodies or somebody's chasing you with a knife. I mean, you're in it. And so I think those in the underbelly, or the people that I sort of write about, the victims and the people who sort of try to solve whatever the crime is, they're in it. They know exactly what it is. They know they see it when they know it when they see it. And you write it that way, all right? At least I do. I can't write it any other. I can't write happy when somebody has just died of an overdose with a 4-month-old baby in the bed next to them. Okay, there's nothing happy about that. And so me trying to sort of put a bow on it and make it all seem sort of cheery and hopeful, it's not hopeful. It's dark, it's unexplainable in some cases. And I kind of like writing that because it's real. It's real. And I think that is a great thing about noir because, as Christina said, it's shiny on top, wonderful buildings at midnight, wonderful picture. But we know that in the sewers, in the little gangways or whatever, I don't know if they have gangways in Chetwynd, Washington. You people are weird, whatever. I mean, but in the alleys, in the
We have
gangways.
alleys.
Yeah, okay, you have alleys. Okay, alleys, gangways. That's where the shit happens. That's where it happens. That's where people die. That's where kids get shot. That's where nobody knows who's dumps in bodies dumped in the dump. I mean, real shit happens.
Yeah.
And you have to sort of write it that way. You can't write it in a happy sort of a wonderful tone. It's not wonderful. And it's unexplainable in a lot of cases. There's no rhyme or reason to it. You could be walking to the grocery store, get a bullet in the back of the head. Now we have to make sense of that. And I think what writers mostly do, whatever genre they write in, is try to answer the question of why? How did this happen? Who would do something like that? What kind of person does it take to? And then you sort of try to answer the question. I do it in the police procedural series that I do. I also do it for the PI, even more with that PI, because that's our champion, right? That's
Right.
our savior on the street. And so I look through her eyes. She sees all of this. She's from the community. It's not any great surprise to her. But you have to deal with what is. You can't think about shiny stuff when it's not shiny. When there's a gang shooting or a 15-year-old gets killed or whatever. Okay, that's the reality. And it's not cute. It's not pretty. It's not neat. There's no explanation for it in a lot of cases. Random crap happens all the freaking time, and you have to make sense of it.
But Christine, when you do, your brand of, or, and again, we're busting through the silos here. I mean, is the why important? And we're gonna, because we're gonna finish up on this kind of industry stuff, where there seems to be a disincentive to talk about the why, and an incentive to write about. And I was explaining it mockingly because it's my podcast and I can, I can cry if I want to when I do this, when I say it's got to be propulsive and twisty and propulsive and twisty and propulsive and twisty. I mean, the why and the, not just not the atmospheric grit, but the why of characters, I think tends to get lost in that. And I see that sometimes. Hope knows, or my producer knows that I say it all the time, and I don't mean to pick on domestic suspense. So all of you out there who write it, stop sending me dead fish, in the mail. But I think that the why and the character, and the heart of it and the psyche of it seems to get lost into this propulsive and twisty mantra is being stamped on people. Particularly in some of these other subgenres. What do are do you is Watch Us Fall kind of a way of subconsciously or consciously fighting back against that, or what's your take?
I don't know. I will tell you why is the reason why I wrote the book. I mean, why is why I left TV. TV doesn't answer why. It tells you who, what, when, where. And it barely does that actually lately. It this kind of climate of lying and deceit. That this era of misinformation, the fact that it is very hard to get straight answers and facts from the people that we have relied on for so long, the death of experts, the attacks on books, I wanted to know why, not why people lied. I mean, we know why. We know that they're getting something out of it, and it's usually money. There's almost always a financial or power thing. And in fact, my character, Josh Egan, he says that he thinks he's an honest person, but he lies. But what he is most afraid of are lies that people use to control people. And that's me. I mean, that's like, so why do people believe lies? And that was really what I wanted to get into. And it was it was a hard thing actually to get at, but I think that right now, to me, it's like the biggest thing that matters. Why are we lying to each other about things that are obviously untrue? Why do we believe the lies? And why are these, how does this get into our closest, most personal relationships? And how on earth are we going to love each other and be neighbors with each other if we keep lying to each other and we cannot trust each other? And why are certain groups of people lied about more than other groups of people? And what the heck is going on? How are we going to survive? And so I wrote this novel with this feeling of intensity, like I had to, hurry up and get this out, and then it just took too long, but I have, for me, my biggest fear, and the reason why I wrote the book, is because we have stopped caring about telling each other the truth, and I don't know where that takes us.
Let me go to that was intense. I love that.
Oh, I'm
That
sorry.
was good. That was all good TV, as Christine would probably say. But I
I
mean,
get very
let me
tense about the story. It drives me
no,
crazy.
and no, that's great. But now I'm gonna ask you something more mundane and pedestrian. Why the either of you, and just jump in, why has our genre, I'm talking about crime fiction now generally, the big silo. What are your thoughts on how women and minorities, of which Tracy and I are, African American, have what explain this kind of your take on almost a takeover? Because and it's, and all takeovers spark reaction, bad and good. This used to be the purview, unless you talked about the cozy, of the white male. Women of color, particular in terms of taking a, like almost like a like a an armored spearhead lead, and women generally have come over as a wave. And have wiped out that whole notion, and it has not been well, the cozies have taken over. It is more of women just really insinuating themselves as artists into these sub blocks, and not invading, if you want to be a male chauvinist, invading. They're invading from the cozies, but just coming in, boom. Right into the subgenres. I mean, where do you think that's come from? I mean, have the people who've been marginalized finally said, no, I'm taking over? Or is it a natural evolution because most readers are women, or are men not getting enough, raw meat crime fiction out there? I mean, what's your take on this? Either of you, just go ahead. This is a freestyle portion of the podcast. But go ahead, either of you. You want to go, Tracy? I know you, and you might have some opinions, strong opinions.
I never have opinions.
Yeah.
I think the motivation basic on a basic level is just you want to put yourself on the page, right? I mean, you want to tell your own stories. I think when I started out, I couldn't imagine writing any other kind of character because that's not my experience. Not like I can't write other characters, but the voice inside of you is your voice. And it comes from your culture or where you were brought up or where you were brought up or how you were brought up, the people that you know, the people who are in your family, the people who are in your community. Those are the stories that were not being told. Or if they were told, they were told from a perspective looking on the outside in. And you sort of want to write the stories from the inside out. You're writing the stories as they apply to you and the community that you know and the people that you know and the voices that you hear. And so that's what I started out wanting to do. And I think every other writer of color does the same thing. We're writing our stories because nobody else either is writing them or writing them the way they should be written or writing them well with a perspective that sort of is respectful of what they're writing about with some kind of gravitas or know-how or, experience. And so it's better to write your own stories, your own characters, because you know them. You write about the communities you know because you are in them. And so that's what motivates us, I think. I can't speak for everybody, but I think most writers of color write their stories because they need to be told. The voice is important. It should be worthy of respect and a spot in the publishing milieu. And so that's it. I mean, just basically, I'm writing the stories that mean something to me, characters that say something to me from my perspective, because everybody else is writing them from a perspective that's not really genuine. And so, I'd rather have the real thing as opposed to the facsimile.
What about you, Christine? I mean, women have blown up in the gritty colloquial sense, this the psychological thriller genre, subgenre. I mean, it just transformed it. Same sentiments as Tracy.
I
What are
mean,
your what's your take?
in a capitalist society, it's simple. I mean, like, because they sell. I mean, Tracy has sold so many books because she's sold so many books because people, nobody's trying to do Tracy a favor. Tracy writes great books and
Ain't
people
that the
buy
truth?
these books. I mean, there is nobody out there that's going to go to any trouble for Tracy. She has made her way. We write good books that people want to read. It's really simple. Now, that said, I mean, like, so my first person perspective is from a woman's perspective, a white chick, a young 23-year-old white chick. There's a third person perspective from a man, and there's the best friend who is a black woman. And I would not go into the first person with a black female narrator because I didn't feel comfortable taking Addie's story. It should be written by a black person. I mean, that's kind of my feeling. Now, in the book I'm writing now, when third person, where there's a black, but my best friend is black, and all the best friends in all my books are always black. I don't know why I always do that, but it's just, it's like you write what you know. And so in the novel that I'm writing now, Sasha is a black woman, but she's third person. So I mean, I'm really careful. I don't think I would ever write a first person guy. I would never, I don't think I would ever write a first person from a different race or ethnicity. Maybe, I don't know, but I would need a lot of help. I mean, when I wrote Addie, I asked my best friend and a bunch of my black friends, hey, does this track? Is this how she would feel? And in Watch Us Fall, Addie, it comes from her two parents are doctors. I mean, she's from that. So I had to go find my friend Jeff Blunt, who's this wonderful writer, who he's a black man, and his children are much like Addie. So I was like, can I follow your kid around? He was like, no, but I'll tell you some stories.
Oh,
But
were
that
you gonna?
ain't
Tr
bad.
No. I talking about tracks. I mean, that totally tracks. Tracy, do you have anything to add or?
I don't know. I think we have to write. I think you can't go wrong if you write human. Okay. I mean, we're all human. We all experience the same things. We might look different on the outside, or we might come from different places, but we have love and lust and hate and all of those human elements that every human being walking the face of the earth now or whoever has. And so I think if you write human, and then if it has a little flavor to it, or Christina wants to write a black character, you write it with respect without the stereotypes that we all are aware of. And if you think you sort of run into a problem like you do, ask, have somebody read it. But I think we should be free to write about whoever. We just have to be, I think, respectful of who we're writing about and concentrate on the elements that are meaningful for character. And for also for the reader. And that's it. I mean, I would hate to be limited to writing just black characters. I write all kinds of characters, men, women, because that's what the world's made up of. And if I was sort of limited to just writing about myself, although I want my, to put my perspective on the page and characters like me on the page, the world is more than that. And so you have to sort of put yourself there, but also put yourself there in the element that it's in society that we're in today, in the world we live in today, with all of the diversity, everybody's different. But write it respectfully, carefully, looking at the the human part, the emotional part, what all we all want to sort of have in our lives. And
Right.
then you don't sort of go too wrong, because if you write them as people, readers will get them as people. And even if you make a mistake here or there, they sort of give you a little, little pass there if you make the effort. So I'm thinking, write about whatever, be respectful as you can, try to get it if you can get it. Let somebody look at it if you're worried about it, but go, just go where your creativity takes you.
Yeah, can I
Great.
add to that?
Oh,
I
go
mean,
ahead.
I totally agree with that. I mean, like, I maybe it's just because I'm a young writer, but I just didn't want to go into Addie's first person POV. But you can't be a DC writer if all you're going to do is write white women. You just
Yeah.
can't. How are you going to? That's not the world. I mean, the
No.
world is every single kind of person, and the dignity of all those people, and how we all live together, and how we don't live together, and how we fight, and how we love, and turn on each other. So yeah, I mean, Tracy, I totally agree with you. I think I just, I'm only on, I'm not, I haven't written as many books as you. I'm not as confident.
Well,
Don't be.
on that, and we're wrapping up here. Each of you, give me a couple of seconds on what you're working on now.
I am
Trace.
working on my first standalone, which is scary as heck. I've written two series so far, and I think I'm kind of comfortable in that sort of series setting. So this is like me on the face of the moon with, running out of oxygen. But I'm ready. It's called You'll Never Find Me. It's my first standalone. I'm not sure what category it is because it's all new to me, but it's sort of a cat and mouse sort of a thing. Mother and young son sort of escaping an abusive husband. She thinks she's gotten far enough away. Turns out she didn't quite go far enough, and hilarity ensues. And that's what the book is about in a nutshell. But tough going, I'm just gonna say. I'm not gonna lie to you, it ain't pretty.
It's going to be a tough Christmas.
Tell me
Right.
about it, dude.
Christine, what are you working on now?
I'm working on my book three. I'm almost
Yay.
here. Yay! My second draft. It's a story about two families at war. They live on Capitol Hill, and two mothers in particular. It involves the death of a young senior in a high school, and how the mothers all try to protect each other and protect their children. I think the tagline is, "What would you do for your child?" or "What wouldn't you do?" But I'm putting it in Capitol Hill, which I'm really happy about because I get to return to my youth.
Well, thank you, Tracy Clark. Newest is Edge, and Christine Kovac. Newest is Watch Us Fall. Thank you for being here. And again, you can find these ladies everywhere because they're best sellers, but their social media is and is all over the place. We will be again on the video on YouTube. Follow us on Incandescent Radio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. And this has been Chris Chambers Noir. See, it hadn't been all that bleak, you
Yeah.
know. People say that's going to be bleak, Chris Chambers Noir, and none of our episodes have been bleak. So again, we'll stay tuned. Our last podcast of the year. Again, I'm going to really load up on the bourbon because. And Bobby Matthews and Chad Williams and all of them. So it's going to be all the way live. So thank you, Tracy, and thank you, Christine. You guys are wonderful.
Yeah, this was
Thank you.
fantastic. You women, holy moly. I'm excited to also feature you on Incandescent Women magazine, where we can get you even more eyeballs and more fans and viewers. And come to Elaine's Literary Salon. That's where Chris and I met, so we can promote you even more. So keep up the great work. Thank you for
Tracy's gonna have to
your
fly from Midway to do
Okay, well, next time you're in
that.
DC. But thank you all, and we really appreciate you bringing women's voices to the forefront. It's really powerful. So thank you to our listeners and readers. Chris, awesome. Like he said, check us out all over the place: Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, Spotify, Apple, iHeart, and most importantly, ChrisChambersNoir.com, where all of these episodes are available for you to look at. Thank you all. Have a beautiful holiday. We'll see you
Same.
in
Thank you.
2026.
Bye-bye.
Yes.